Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, we revisit the contentious, extended, but not extensive hearings that led to the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to serve on the United States Supreme Court for life. Jennifer Briney returns. She presides over the podcast Congressional Dish. She reads all the bills. She looks at all the hearings. And she's developed a style of personality journalism that I really admire and respect. Today she joins me and we talk about certain aspects of the Kavanaugh confirmation process and why it should lead to a wholesale replacement of the members of the United States Senate. Now, I firmly believe that Brett Kavanaugh repeatedly lied before the Senate. It's called perjury. Will he ever face an accounting? We'll see. This podcast is made possible by great listeners like you, including Kyle McClary and David Michaeletz. They just renewed their annual subscriptions. Jason Ferguson and Peter J. Hoffmeister kick in $5 a month every month. They set a model for you to follow. Follow them on over to peterbcollins.com. Click menu, then become a subscriber. You land on the sign-up page, and boom, you can take it from there. Thanks for listening to this podcast, and as always, thanks for your support. Jennifer Briney from Congressional Dish returns. We're going to talk Kavanaugh today. Kavanaugh's pants, in fact, did not catch fire during his confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we understand that they were made of a special flame-proof cloth. Jennifer Briney pays attention to what goes on in Washington in some ways so we don't have to, and in some ways, I think, to keep herself from going stark raving mad. Jen, welcome back to the PBC podcast.
Thank you for having me back.
Explain to new listeners Congressional Dish and your mission, please.
I'm still trying to figure that out. Congressional Dish is my way of, I don't know, figuring out what they're doing with my tax money and in my name. And mm-hmm. I didn't know who to believe on the television, so I just started reading primary documents. I started reading the bills themselves and watching hearings. And I was just finding so much information that I couldn't find anywhere else. And so I decided to share it on a podcast. So I've been doing this now for 6 years. And yeah, I'm just looking into the stories that aren't being told, really. Yeah. Which I guess Kavanaugh doesn't really fall into that category. But what I also did is I watched the hearings that weren't about sex. So that's where I was looking into things that were mm-hmm. not being discussed by the mainstream media.
And I think in your podcast, you said this was your first full-fledged Supreme Court confirmation hearing that you've covered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even with Neil Gorsuch, I mean, it just kind of felt like we were replacing Scalia with another right-winger. So, like, who cares? Mm-hmm. So I really didn't pay any attention. But this one was different, where it was the swing seat. And
you called him the baloney.
Yes.
Anthony Kennedy was the baloney in the SCOTUS sandwich.
He was.
Sometimes sticking to the white bread and sometimes the whole wheat. Huh?
I did say that, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a way with words, don't I?
I actually took notes and wrote down things that you said, and I'm going to refresh your memory.
Thank you, because that was actually a while ago. I've been doing the tax bill for the last few weeks. So, yeah.
And you have no problem getting to sleep at night if you're working on the tax stuff, right?
Oh, I have no problem getting to sleep in the middle of the day.
Well, tell me what your overall reaction was just to the contrived drama of the confirmation hearing, because the Republican majority used its raw power in the most raw way that I've seen, and I've been watching confirmation hearings a little longer than you.
Yeah. You know, it was, I guess I can't really call it surprising because I've seen them do this so many times with legislation where they ram it through. But just the speed of these confirmation hearings and how little they gave a crap about Christine Blasey Ford's accusations, it was just so fast and it was just so clear that these were never going to be real investigations, that they were never really asking him real questions. Those pretty much all came from the Democrats, although not really. It was just the speed of it that was, it was shameful. You know, like, we have these processes. This is a lifetime appointment. And you would just hope that they would really want to know, you know, who this person is and how he feels about different subjects. Is he really going to be an impartial judge, or is he going to basically legislate from the bench? And that was just never really investigated. They want to get a they wanted a W. Bush administration guy on the court, and that's all that really mattered.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was sad, really. That's really, I was very sad when producing that episode. It wasn't even anger anymore.
Yeah,
I was just disappointed.
Well, Jen, I have the dubious distinction that I covered the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. I was there in Washington in the Judiciary Committee hearings.
Oh, wow.
And I was there for the first phase before we'd ever heard of Anita Hill. And that's roughly comparable to the way this one played out, where there was a break between the introduction of the sex charges and the first phase.
Yeah.
And what was remarkable there was Joe Biden, who still thinks he is presidential material. he was the chair of the Judiciary Committee at the time. Ted Kennedy was a prominent member. And I recall Howell Heflin was this chubby judge guy from Alabama. And the three of them were arrayed there, and they couldn't bring themselves to actually tell Clarence Thomas to his face that they didn't think he was qualified to be on the Supreme Court. They were afraid, because he was a black conservative, that the race card would, you know, backfire on them. And so I sat there squirming and watched as, you know, they went through the motions of asking him questions and, is this settled law? Is this stare decisis? So the same script plays out each time. And it was just clear that this guy didn't, you know, have any business being there. Mm. But the Democrats, you know, didn't have the balls to say that. Or to confront him on, you know, very legitimate issues about his qualifications. And then when Anita Hill surfaced and they turned it into the soap opera that it became, it created the opportunity for Clarence Thomas to give his Brett Kavanaugh-type unhinged speech. He didn't say, "I like Coke." he just said that this is...
I still like Coke.
This is a high-tech lynching. And it was a very effective brushback, and it really is the script that Don McGahn dredged up from the White House files when he sat down and coached Kavanaugh on how he was going to respond to Christine Blasey Ford.
Oh, interesting.
And once again, the Democrats, you know, are left with egg on their faces, really too polite. But they, you know, they were unable to really conclude in a way that disqualified the nominee. Mm. And I believe that, you know, putting aside whether we believe Blasey Ford or not, that Brett Kavanaugh lied repeatedly under oath about his previous lies in 2006. And Senator Leahy, I think, was pretty effective in drawing those out, although he could not bring himself to call them lies.
Yeah, they're just... The Democrats are so frustrating to me because, I mean, the strategy that I would have used in that sexual assault hearing is that the Republicans had a special victims prosecutor sitting there, and she was allowed to ask questions. If I were the Democrats, I would gather my people together and let her ask all the questions. But they had to grandstand, and they were all asking different topics, and it was just so unorganized and so ineffective. And that's where I get so frustrated with the Democrats. Mm-hmm. It's like, yes, they are the lesser of two evils, but they're so ineffective. And yeah, it was just, it was frustrating. Yeah. But going back into the 90s, mm-hmm. the process, was it this fast or was this truly extraordinary?
It happened almost as fast. The Senate doesn't typically allow more than a week for these proceedings.
That's crazy.
It is. Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I really thank you for, I listened to the first hour of your podcast, and so there may be other things that I've missed. But you went into great detail about the way that Brett Kavanaugh, who wrote the Presidential Records Act executive order that yeah. was endorsed by George W. Bush, essentially was in control of which documents the Democrats could gain access to and the hundreds of thousands that they were forbidden to see.
Yeah.
And this game played out behind the scenes over the course of the summer. And you also played the clip, the dramatic opening sequence where Chuck Grassley is trying to welcome this wonderful man, the father of two beautiful daughters. And he's just repeatedly peppered with interruptions, starting with California's Kamala Harris saying this hearing can't go forward. You just dropped, 46,000 documents on us last night?
Something close to that, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was... I mean, they knew. That was the part that was so amazing to me. It was put in writing by the National Archives that we will not be done with even the small amount of, I mean, it's not small. They asked for, I think, 900,000 documents. So it's not small, but compared to the millions of documents that this Bush administration guy, you know, had, they wanted 900,000. They were told in no uncertain terms, these won't be done until October. And so they decided to have the hearings anyway in September. And it was fascinating to watch it play out where these senators are like, why are there some documents that we're supposed to have that we now can't see? They didn't know. And then over the course of the few days, they found out, oh, it was the W. Bush administration that's shutting all this down. And I feel like that's a story that there were a lot of, you could hear the protesters yelling, you know, show us the documents. And the documents, there was a story about that. But we never really heard the executive order part. We never really understood why it's possible for George W. Bush and Dick Cheney to still be hiding so many documents, so many more than the Presidential Records Act even allows them to hide. It was this executive order that expanded it. And Kavanaugh used the very executive order that he wrote to hide information about his.
And you don't even need an excuse. Right. You don't even have to claim national security or ongoing investigation. It's just no.
Yeah. It's for 12 years. They can pretty much hide whatever they want. We're still in that window.
Mm-hmm.
And then after there was a group of six kinds of documents. Like originally they were just supposed to be able to hide this six kind. And so the executive order expanded it to anything for that 12-year window. But then after the 12-year window, you go back to that list of six kinds of documents. And it's a pretty broad list. And then they're able to hide those indefinitely mm-hmm. after that. It's a massive shift towards secrecy.
Yeah, yeah.
It just shows you that the Bush administration never really ended.
Well, and that the politics of this cannot be separated from the process.
No.
The reason they had to ram it through is they feared that if they didn't do it in September, it wouldn't happen until the lame duck session in November. And if the complexion of Congress changes sufficiently, that could have, derailed their plan to put this arch conservative as the swing vote on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And so they were not going to let anything get in the way of this train.
No. And they also had to ram it through because as the documents come out, we're going to learn more about this guy. Mm-hmm. We just are. And he was in an administration, as I said on my show, that tortured people and set up an illegal spying apparatus that's spying on the entire world and starting an illegal war. We're going to find something out, you know. So they also had to ram it through just to make sure that whatever paper is coming didn't happen before the confirmation. Because the thing about the allegations is, again, this was all from high school. So we're not entirely sure what happened. But if you have something on paper, that's about a policy, that's about something serious, that can derail a confirmation in a way that a sexual assault allegation, I mean, it was never... I just feel like it's easier to derail a confirmation if it's about policy than about something that happened when he was 17, as horrible as that was.
Well, but in a lot of ways, policy gets walled off because the nominee can say, you know, Senator, I'd love to comment on that, but it might come before the court.
And so he did that a lot.
You know, you can talk about the past a little bit, but, you know, they have, you know, pretty good defense from getting into policy issues in a deep way. Mm-hmm. So it does boil down to gotcha. And in my view, they did get him. Not the central charge from Christine Blasey Ford, because her details are lacking, and it is difficult to come to a conclusion about what she alleged. Mm-hmm. But it's clear from all the other witnesses who surfaced, Yale classmates, the other accusers, that he has lied.
Yeah.
And it wasn't only about the issues related to the 06 confirmation and the stolen documents from the Democrats that Leahy grilled him on. It was really his drinking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these have not been investigated. We know that the FBI's reinvestigation was worse than a joke.
It was fake.
Just a total farce.
Yeah.
That also exposes the whole, you know, background investigation bullshit, because they only talk to people who are on the list supplied by the nominee.
Mm-hmm.
And unless those people go off on the nominee, nothing untoward is going to be revealed through that silly background check process. But yesterday, Chuck Grassley took what I think is a very risky move, because he referred Michael Avenatti and Julie Swetnick to the Justice Department for further investigation, alleging that they made materially false statements to Grassley's committee as it investigated.
Oh, boy.
Now, this puts it under the control of Jefferson Beauregard Jim Crow Sessions III, who is desperate to hold on to his job. And, you know, he's got a calendar with 11 days remaining on it.
Yeah.
So he wants to save his skin. And what will he do with this charge, this referral from Grassley? Well, it's unlikely to be pursued by those, you know, career prosecutors who have no political bias. But this, to me, like I said, is a risky move by Grassley, because if there is a real investigation into Julie Swetnick's allegations, which involve group sex or trains where a woman was drunk or drugged and, you know, used by more than one male, that is a very serious charge. He flatly denies every aspect of it.
Yeah.
And if only one part of it can be confirmed through this first investigation of Julie Swetnick's...
This revenge investigation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... But they're so ballsy now. They've gotten away with all of it. That's the thing. They've been doing this type of shady stuff for so long. I've never quite seen the judicial branch used as a weapon as much as I'm seeing it now. Granted, I'm only 35, so I wasn't there for like the Nixon years and all that. But
well, I can share with you that the last time the Justice Department was this political was during Nixon's administration.
Yeah.
And I was a young talk show host in Chicago, and Watergate was my ticket to success. I jumped up in the ratings because I was covering Watergate every night. And what we learned was that John Mitchell, who was his attorney general, was, and he was convicted, and he was sentenced to prison. I don't think he ever did any actual time. But Mitchell was corrupt, and he was running the Justice Department the way Donald Trump wants Jeff Sessions to run it, as a political hatchet shop.
Yeah.
And a way of using the law to skewer your opponents, real or imagined.
Yeah. And actually, you know, I'm no fan of Jeff Sessions, but he hasn't been doing exactly what Trump wants. He's been an interesting figure in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so sad when I'm a little bit grateful for Jeff Sessions.
Like, it sure is.
Oh, wow, what a state of affairs.
No,
but he hasn't been as political as Trump wants him to be.
Right.
We're getting lucky in that regard.
But it is perverse that there are Democrats who now want to keep Jeff Sessions as attorney general as a way of preventing the firing of Mueller, which, you know, it's not clear that that would actually happen. But it's certainly something we know Trump would like to do. And since his advisors can't stop him from even using an iPhone that is insecure, we can't imagine.
All that Hillary stuff, too. Like, really? But again, getting away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Continuing to get away with it. They're getting away with everything.
Well, and here is the real monster thing that even surprises me, Jen. That is that within 24 hours of installing Brett Kavanaugh on the court, they had launched the white male victim meme, and this has taken on a new life for Trump, where, you know, white men identify with Kavanaugh, and they believe that, you know, the Democrats made this up. They created Christine Blasey Ford.
Yeah, it's weird.
And I believe that Trump's lies are prevailing at the moment. Now, we're speaking on the day that the suspect has been arrested in the pipe bomb scheme that Trump, just hours before the arrest, said was probably phony. He put bomb thing in quotes.
I saw that.
Yeah.
But it's a Floridian baby boomer that's a big Trump fan, lives in his mom's basement. Like, God. Because of course he is.
Well, let me take a moment here. I have a friend, Larissa Alexandrovna, who used to write for Raw Story, and she has been putting up Facebook posts about these various issues. And when the pipe bombing stories started to surface, she said, it's going to be a white male, and he's apparently part Native American.
He says he is.
And his name is Cesar, so his ethnicity is a little bit murky. But she also said that people who make bombs aren't getting laid and that she suspected that he lives with his mom.
Yeah.
And Larissa got boom. 2 out of 3 right.
Yeah. It's so funny. That's the first thing I saw this morning. I'm like, oh, my God. I yelled at my husband. I'm like, he lives with his mom. And because no one is hurt, I feel like I can laugh about the whole thing. Because he's also like the worst assassin ever.
Yeah.
You know, like he accomplished nothing except a very long prison sentence. But yeah, it's madness, pure madness.
And so what is your sense of the implications as you look at the ascension of Brett Kavanaugh and the way that he was put on the court? Do you think that he will get over his anger and be the kind of, you know, wise judge that he pretended he would be in the first round of hearings? Or do you think that his anger will be unleashed and we will see it play out?
You know, after watching, because I watched his 2004 hearings, 2006, and then the 4 days that he did when no one was paying attention. And after watching him for that long, I mean, he definitely knows the law backward and forward. I will say that I think that he is qualified. And I don't know. I think that he reveres the other people in the court so much that I do think that he might behave himself. I disagree with him on, you know, some of the views he has. Like, he's a very religious person. I'm definitely not. And I'm hoping that he can keep his personal views out of it. But he promised it over and over again. And he talked about judicial independence so many times over so many years. I am a little bit hopeful that he's not a stark raving lunatic and that he'll get up there and see himself sitting next to Ruth Bader Ginsburg and people that he does respect. I mean, he showed respect for every single person that he talked about on the Supreme Court. So I don't think that he's going to go up there and behave like a giant baby. I think he's going to want to prove himself. So I'm less fatalistic about the fact that he's on the court than I am about the norms of the Senate and Congress in general just going completely out the window. Like, that's the part of this that's just stunning to me, because if anything is allowed, these Republicans are doing it. Like, even now, they're confirming judges, even though the Congress isn't
right.
in session.
Yeah.
Like, that, they've gotten so brazen with just twisting the rules to get whatever they want in any way that they can. That's the part that I'm more concerned about.
I don't quite share your optimism about Kavanaugh because of his deep political base. And he is a movement conservative who identifies with the Republican Party. And it because I'm a former Catholic and I went to a Jesuit school just like Georgetown Prep. In fact, I'll tell you that in the 1930s, three of my uncles attended Georgetown Prep when it was a boarding school, and one of them got kicked out. And we believe he may have been the founder of the 100 Kegs of Beer Club.
Oh, boy.
That Kavanaugh took over when he was there.
Yeah.
But
in high school. Like, I could see that happening in college, but 100 kegs in high school? Like, where are your parents?
Well, Mom was a judge.
Yeah, she was busy.
She didn't see any crimes in her house.
Yeah.
So the nexus of conservative Republican politics and people who are faithful Catholics is very troubling to me, because the righteousness that they can summon is like judgment, you know, with a capital J, the godlike judgment.
Yeah.
And they can use it to rationalize war and torture and denying contraception. You know, abortion, I consider to be a moral issue, and I respect some people who, you know, don't support it. And there are a lot of good people who personally are morally opposed, but they feel that it's a secular issue and that that shouldn't drive the law.
Yeah.
He's not like that. We saw in the Jane Doe decision, the migrant teenager who was pregnant and who the God Squad was stopping from accessing her right to an abortion.
Yeah.
That was appealed to the D.C. Circuit. And Kavanaugh's opinion was similar to what I just described. It was based on a Catholic faith and a righteous interpretation of it.
Yeah. His decision made it so that it was getting delayed to the point that she might not legally be allowed to get it anymore. I mean, there's definitely reasons for pessimism. But even that was the thing. Even listening to his explanation of that ruling, he said that I mean, this is just what he said. This is the problem. I mean, who knows? But he said that when he made that ruling, it was like 5 or 7 days he wanted it to wait. But he said that after a certain amount of time, she can get the abortion. So it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, you look at this decision itself, but then you hear him talk about it. And it's like, I may not like where you ended up, but I at least can see it. I'm just looking for optimism anywhere I can find it. That's what I'm doing.
Jen, one of the other things that you highlighted in your podcast at Congressional Dish about the Kavanaugh hearings was a set of information that I didn't know about Anthony Kennedy. I didn't know about his son working for Deutsche Bank and signing off on $1 billion worth of loans to the Trump organization over a 10-year period.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's actually the global head of real estate. I don't know if he currently is, but he was for at least 10 years and has a long relationship with the Trump – or not the administration, the Trump family.
Yeah. 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 And, of course, that's not germane to Kavanaugh, and it certainly didn't come up in the confirmation hearings. But it is amazing.
I don't think it's not germane, because the thing is that Justice Kennedy had a role in choosing both of Trump's picks. They were both his clerks. So I don't know. I think it is valid, because for Justice Kennedy to be like, oh, well, I have a family connection to this guy, and then to choose to give up its seat. Like, it's one thing for Scalia to drop dead, but Kennedy chose to let Trump pick who's in his seat. And I have to believe the fact that he had a direct line in picking who would fill it.
Well, I agree with you on that aspect, and I wouldn't have objected if the confirmation hearings explored that.
Yeah.
But they're very narrowly focused. And where I was going is I believe the media failed to alert us to this as it was in process, that when Kennedy announced his retirement, that's the time when the New York Times should have told us about his son.
Well, to be fair, that's where I got it from.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was the Times. I have the source in my show notes, but it was the media. The thing is, it wasn't amplified.
Right.
So
No, it was reported, and I'm not disputing that.
Yeah.
But this is something that there should have been justifiable outrage about.
It should have been wall-to-wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And so much of the stuff I talk about should be wall-to-wall coverage.
And then the points you made about, you know, essentially Kennedy picking his replacement. We know that Mitch McConnell didn't favor Kavanaugh because of the big paper trail, because of the history of his difficult confirmation the last time.
Yeah. It took 2 years to get him on the D.C. Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. It's a long time.
And so somebody bulldozed Mitch McConnell, which doesn't happen too often.
Sounds like a Trump move.
And let me look at my notes here. Let's go back to the Democrats for a moment, because one of the issues after he was confirmed, I interviewed John Bonifaz. And Bonifaz and two others have published a book about impeaching Trump, and they launched Impeach Brett after he was confirmed. And they based it on the lies that we believe he delivered in that hearing. And when they talk about impeaching a Supreme Court justice, that is the only way, other than resignation or death, to get somebody off the court. And one of the things that Bonifaz mentioned was how the Democrats were not willing to call his lies lies.
Yeah.
And so even though they were constrained into these 5-minute little modules, they didn't really use them effectively to get the critical issue that should have disqualified him on the record and out there in the open.
Well, the Democrats are still playing by old rules. They're still trying to have some kind of like gentlemanly discourse, and they're behaving as if the Senate norms still exist while the Republicans are blowing them up. And that's just – it's just a kind of a perfect example of their ineffectiveness. Like, yes, the Democrats don't have a lot of power, but they still have C-SPAN all day, every day on the floor of the House and the Senate. So get up there and, like, say some things. Don't mince your words and pretend that you're best friends with these people. Like, get angry, make a fuss so that the news has to show it, you know? You know, there's just so many more ways for them to effectively communicate with the American people what's happening here. And instead, they're just being polite. Like, I think the time for politeness is over. But so many of them have been in Congress for so long that they've fallen into this pattern. This is why I'm really hopeful for, and I can't pronounce her name to save my life,
Ocasio. It's Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez.
Her.
Mm-hmm. That one.
She can communicate real well. So I would just like to see her get in there and start screaming, you know, because that was something that was definitely lacking. You're absolutely right. And not just the Kavanaugh hearings. In so many of these hearings.
But don't you admire the tough questioning of our senior senator from California,
no.
Dianne Feinstein?
That woman, no. I am so sick of her. No, she was very polite. Very polite. Like, I'm she's been there too long. She's been there too long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she considers Chuck Grassley a friend. Like, no. I just feel like I have these like daydreams where I'm there, you know, what would I do? And it would be so hard for me to keep my cool, you know, and just pretend that what these people are doing is okay. And she does. And Kamala Harris is a little bit better. She will call a spade most of the time. But Dianne Feinstein, I mean, she is one of the good old boys, you know, and I think that's why she behaves that way. It's all so nice.
So when Jeff Flake got up and crossed the room there, behind all the Republicans, went over to Chris Coons of Delaware and said, "Hey, you, come on out. I want to talk to you."
They're good friends.
What was your impression of that? How did you react?
Well, I don't know how I know this, but I knew that Flake and Coons were buddies, like actual had a personal relationship. But it annoyed me that Coons was just asking for this investigation, and he was the one that suggested that it only be a week. So. And that was just a way to be like, this will get us to shut up, you know, like, so have the fake investigation, then we can move forward. It was like they were almost co-conspirators in that fake investigation. And sure enough, it appeased a lot of stuff. And Jeff Flake, Jeff Flake only had power in that committee. So the fact that he voted yes to move that confirmation into the full House, like if he actually wanted an investigation, if he actually wanted to be the hero, he would say, I am not voting yes to move this until an investigation is done. That's not what he did. He just said, like, I'll vote yes today and make sure we have this fake investigation, and Chris is happy with me. So it was a personal relationship that made that happen. But it was also all bullshit. The entire thing, the entire drama, the minute he voted yes, we knew that it was going to be fake. Because at that point, it's Mitch McConnell's deal, you know, and he was always going to rush that confirmation. That it was a gentleman's promise. Once again, the Democrats are taking gentlemen's promises from the Republicans.
Well, and Chris Coons continued to run interference for both Flake and for the phony investigation in the days that followed. And then the Democrats just threw in the towel.
and it just makes you wonder, like, were they ever against it to begin with?
Well, and they lost any leverage to try to shame Flake into voting against on the floor. I mean, once he had voted in committee, that die was cast, but it didn't require him to repeat it when the confirmation went to the floor. And because we had, what, one guy who was out at a wedding in Montana, it could have, you know, at least delayed until Sunday the final vote that occurred on a Saturday.
Yeah.
But the Democrats, you know, largely caved at that point. And so as we look back, we see them scoring points with, you know, little video clips that went viral, like Cory Booker, who took this dramatic position that he's going to release documents. And if you drum me out of the Senate, it's okay with me.
Which were already released.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It was phony.
Yeah. Yeah. They're just a bunch of phonies. And then in the aftermath of all this, they wanted to go campaigning. So in a block, they confirmed 15 of Trump's judges. Like that, that's the Democrats for you.
Well,
that's your resistance.
As you alluded to earlier, Jen, then the Republicans kept going through. They can't confirm without the Democrats there to have a vote. But they went through the committee hearings on a number of nominees, some of which, you know, there's this blue slip process that is now basically out the window.
It was a norm.
Traditionally, a nominee had to get the approval of both senators from that person's state in order to move forward toward confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
And this started in Oregon a few months ago, where both Wyden and the other guy, Merkley, opposed a Republican nominee, and they just ignored it.
Yeah.
And went ahead and confirmed the guy. And there's now a case here from California that's moving through the pipeline, an unqualified right-winger, and both senators oppose it, and the Republicans are just saying so.
Same in Washington. Yeah, both Washington senators don't want this person. Yeah, and when I look at the Democrats, you know, our own Dianne Feinstein, she could stop a lot of this by going back to Washington. You know, stop campaigning and do your damn job. And I might actually vote for you. But I'm not going to vote for you now because you think going to, you know, these speeches or whatever she's doing. I don't even know what she's doing. I'm in California and I haven't heard anything from her. So I don't know what she's doing. But she's sure as hell not going back to the Senate Judiciary Committee and doing anything about these hearings going forward. Their priorities are just so whack. It's they're trying to win elections and not doing their jobs.
So now we need to bring this back to the voter level, okay? In your podcast, I really appreciated, right about the point where I stopped listening, about an hour in, you got pretty worked up and you said, we need to fire these senators.
We do.
And here in California, there is a decent guy who is running against Dianne Feinstein. His name is Kevin DeLeon. I have some issues because when he was the running the state Senate in Sacramento, he took in a lot of corporate cash, and I don't have total faith in him. But he has positioned himself as a fighter, as somebody who would take on the Republicans, and that is a very different profile than what Dianne Feinstein offers.
She's a partner with them on so many things because she's we've been focusing on her Senate Judiciary Committee position, but she's been on the Intelligence Committee forever. And so she's been helping them with this spying stuff, and she's always voting for the Patriot Act. And, like, she is an enemy when it comes to the Fourth Amendment and has been for a long time. So just there's some issues where she is just as bad.
The only exception to that was she pushed for the torture report, and Barack Obama teamed up with John Brennan and with the Republicans to completely bury it.
Yeah.
And it's the only good thing I can say about her in recent years.
Yeah.
And Jen, this may surprise you a little, but I work on political campaigns from time to time. And in 2000, I worked for her Republican opponent. Tom Campbell is a moderate Republican who ran against Feinstein. That was the last time she debated on live television in 2000. This year, she agreed to an online debate, a single debate held at noon on a weekday with Kevin DeLeon.
That's crazy.
And so I have believed for a long time that Dianne Feinstein is out of step with the voters of California, but the voters of California haven't backed me up, Jen.
Well, they know her name.
Yep.
And that's the thing. Like, it's a celebrity contest. I don't know. I'm hoping my generation will step up. That's what I'm hoping for.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just, when I look at Congress as a whole, what I want to see is an anti-incumbent wave. It's not just, obviously I want the Republicans, these particular Republicans gone. Because mm-hmm. They're blowing up the Senate and the House to get whatever they want. So I'm just – the process that I've witnessed in these last 6 years of doing this podcast is just horrendous, the way that they govern. So I'm not – obviously not a fan of them. But the Democrats, too, I mean, I've kind of waxed poetic about this already, but they're complicit
mm-hmm.
with everything that's happening. They're not effective resistance, and I think that that's a sin bad enough for them to get fired. And I don't think that there's anyone good enough – in the Democratic Party, not one, that I would really be all that upset about being dismissed in the wave. I guess the only person that popped in my head, and I was like, I'd be sad if this person left, is Bernie Sanders, but he's an independent. So, yeah, there's just no one that valuable to me that we'd have to keep them. So I'm just hoping that people are sick enough that they're paying attention and that they're going to vote in November 6th. And I'm just so fatalistic at this point. Like, I don't know what's going to happen.
I don't either. And I am very concerned that the voter suppression schemes will once again be effective enough to keep the a lot of these seats for Republicans.
Yeah.
And, the Democrats become aware of voter suppression issues usually about 60 days before the election.
Yeah.
And I talk about it all year long, you know, election year, not election year, because this is where it has been stolen from us.
Yeah.
And they talk about voter fraud while they commit incredible acts of election fraud.
Yeah. And the Democrats aren't hammering away at that. They're not making it a major issue. They're just ineffective.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly frustrating, even when it hurts them. But I think a part of that is, too, like gerrymandering is a good example. The Democrats don't really want to go after the Republicans for it because they want to get the state houses so that they can do it. You know, I think it was Ohio was one of those states that the Democrats, they gerrymandered. So it's really hard to fight bad behavior when your goal is to get power so that you can do the same damn thing. So we really do need people that are moral and better than that. And right now, the Democratic Party, that's just not what they are. And I don't know what the solution is. I have so many people like, well, then what do we do? And I'm like, I don't know. That's the frustrating part. Like, I have no answers. I can sit here all day and tell you all the problems, but I don't know how we fix this mm-hmm. other than really taking responsibility for the three people. It's not that many. We have two senators and one in the House. We have to really take responsibility for who they are. But right now, there's a lot of people that don't even know we're having an election. So what do we do about that? I mean, you and I have these conversations, but we're pretty much just talking to ourselves. Everyone that's been paying attention in my life is the same people that was paying attention before Trump was elected. Like, I'm not seeing in my world the wave, you know? And maybe I'm too close to it, but I'm not feeling good about any of it, unfortunately.
Well, this is the point where I'd love to offer optimistic platitudes and, it's all going to work out and the people will have their way. But we have so much idiocy that is being proudly displayed on a daily basis that it leaves many of us stressed out and hopeless.
Yeah, I'm not quite hopeless yet. that's when I wrap up the podcast and move to Mexico. And I'm just like, bye. I'm surfing every day. See ya. And I'm not there yet, just because my generation hasn't bothered voting yet. Mm-hmm. But I also don't think that they've been convinced yet. I don't know. We're going to find out. It's tough to have this conversation right now. We're going to find out in 2 weeks. Because there were a lot of people in my generation that were freaked out that Hillary didn't win. Mm-hmm. So maybe they'll show up. I don't know.
She doesn't know.
I did.
Well, Jen, as we wrap up here, let me ask you to highlight for our listeners a couple of recent podcasts on your site and what you covered and, you know, maybe just a little nugget of what the surprises were. I saw a recent post about the budget bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that episode, I went through the 2018 funding, because what I've noticed is that when the president releases his budget, which is that document is as useful as toilet paper. Mm-hmm. It does nothing. But that's what's always covered. So last, it was February, I think, of 2017, the media's like, Trump's going to cut this and that, and it's a disaster, blah, blah. This went on for like 6 weeks. But then when the actual government was funded, mm-hmm. 6 months late, they didn't really look into what it was. So I did. I compared what did Trump want and what actually got funded. And I was shocked at how different it was. It was very, very different. So a lot of the cuts, which Trump asked for some very extreme cuts, because mm-hmm. he's letting Mick Mulvaney do all of this, and right. he is an anti-government zealot. So it was really a Mick Mulvaney budget. And the Republicans didn't do it. Like, they pretty much increased funding in every way, which is so ironic considering they're considered, you know, fiscally responsible and all. Like, they increased funding for everything, especially war. So that was interesting to just go through it line by line and to see those big differences. It was very different, even for me. I was surprised at how surprised I was. And then there was another episode.
Just on your point there about funding for the Pentagon, the Democrats made no effort to cut funding for the Pentagon or even to reduce the amount of the increase the Republicans were promoting. They only talked about parity for restoring domestic programs that have been cut under the sequester.
Yeah.
And I just found that mind-boggling that they gave the Pentagon $50 or $70 billion, and there's no war. There is no need for it. It's there if Trump wants to start a war with Iran.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of those issues where the Democratic Party as a whole is complicit with the Republican Party. There's mm-hmm. no sunlight between mm-hmm. them. There are some anti-war people in Congress, and most of them, with the exception of Bernie Sanders, most of them are in the Democratic Party. Although, you know what? That might be bullshit. No, that's not true.
Well, I think...
because Rand Paul, I think he legit is not a fan of these wars. Mike Lee, I can think of some Republicans. There is a coalition of people that's truly anti-war, but they are so outnumbered mm-hmm. that when you look at the leadership of the two parties...
It's Walter Jones from North Carolina. Yeah. There's Justin Amash from Michigan. There's a guy with a conscience from Kentucky, Massey.
Yes.
But that's about it on the Republican side. Yeah.
And then in the Senate, Mike Lee, Rand Paul.
Mm-hmm.
The end.
But Barbara Lee, Mark Pocan, Ro Khanna, the new guy from Silicon Valley.
Yeah, Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah, they have pushed war powers resolutions to try to get the Congress to take a position on the current conflicts and to try to prevent a blank check for future ones. Yeah. And they're not getting very far.
No, and Tulsi Gabbard actually did a great interview on Joe Rogan's podcast where she talked about how frustrating that was, that she wanted to basically declare wars again. And I think... it got 30% mm-hmm. support.
That's
where we're looking. Between the two parties, 70% of them combined, of those 535 people that are representing us, they're pushing war. And the Democrats are not resisting it whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, I interviewed Lee Camp earlier today, and he said that mainly the resistance is objecting to hush money for porn stars.
I mean, yeah. I love Lee. He does not mince his words.
No, he doesn't.
At all. And I appreciate it because I mince mine like garlic.
Yeah.
I'm very careful.
Well, but I have to say, you know, I only listen to you occasionally, but I am hearing you really grow in strength and in, you know, your own center of power.
And well, thank you.
I want you to keep it up. I think you have a very... strong voice based on information. And I think that there is a generation of new reporters and media people coming up. And I consider you one of them. Kevin Gostola at Shadowproof is an excellent young journalist. Steve Horn, who's been covering fracking and pipelines, he's now shifted to the prison industrial complex. He's a very bright young guy. And I don't want to leave anybody else out, but there is a whole wave of young people who I respect, and I include you among those.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I think my generation... What I'm noticing is we were raised with the internet, so I think it's shocking to a lot of like baby boomers in my life, just like fake news, where for me, like I've been seeing fake stuff the whole time, so it doesn't really shock me. But I demand to see your sources, and a lot of us are like that. Like even Dax Shepard, I mean, he's a little bit older than me, but his Armchair Expert podcast, he does a fact check on his nonsense. Like, he's just talking to celebrities, but he fact checks what he says. So I think that's becoming more and more important. And that's the type of stuff that, like, Steve does and I do and Lee Fong. And it's like the people that bother to link in what they write and have show notes for the podcast. I think you're only going to see more and more of that. And that's where my hope lies, that that there are people that are going to filter this for us and help us figure it out. And the only question for me is, are we going to vote so that we actually have some power to make things better, or are we just documenting the apocalypse? Because that's where I'm at. This used to be fun. It used to be so fun for me when I started this to find all the little scandals that no one knew about. But now there's so many people researching scandals that I just feel like I'm just adding to it. You know, I wish I could figure out a solution or just, but that's where my frustration is now. It's like there's so much corruption in the document now, and it's so out in the open. What's the point? A few years ago, it didn't feel like this. Now, unless someone's held accountable, I don't know what I'm doing this for.
Jennifer Briney, I hope you'll keep doing it and discover why.
Do you have a reason why I'm doing this? Do you know what my goal is?
I'll get back to you. Okay. We'll do some focus groups and figure it out.
Sounds good.
Jennifer Briney, Congressional Dish, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Jennifer Briney of Congressional Dish. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.